frightening. For now the world seemed to flow before my eyes. All boundaries down, freedom was not only the recognition of necessity, it was the recognition of possibility. And sitting there trembling, I caught a brief glimpse of the possibilities posed by Reinhardt's multiple personalities and turned away. It was too vast and confusing to contemplate. Then I looked at the polished lenses of the glasses and laughed. I'd been trying, simply, to turn them into a disguise, but they had become a political instrument instead. For if Reinhardt could use them in his work, no doubt I could use them in mine. It was too simple. And yet they had already opened up a new section of reality for me. What would the committee say about that? What did their theory tell them of such a world? I recall the report of a shoeshine boy who had encountered the best treatment in the South simply by wearing a white turban instead of his usual Dobbs or Stetson, and I fell into a fit of laughing. Jack would be outraged at the very suggestion of such a state of things, and yet there was truth in it. This was the real chaos which he thought he was describing. So long ago, it seemed now. Outside the Brotherhood, we were outside history, but inside of it, they didn't see us. It was a hell of a state of affairs. We were nowhere. I wanted to back away from it, but still I wanted to discuss it, to consult someone who'd tell me it was only a brief emotional illusion. I wanted the props put back beneath the world. So now I had a real need to see Hambro. Getting up to go, I looked at the wall map and laughed at Columbus. What an India he'd found. I was almost across the hall when I remembered and came back and put on the hat and glasses. I'd need them to carry me through the streets. I took a cab. Hambro lived in the West 80s, and once in the vestibule I tucked the hat under my arm and put the glasses in my pocket along with Brother Tarp's leg chain and Clifton's doll. My pocket was getting overloaded. I was shown into a small book-lined study by Hambro himself. From another part of the apartment came a child's voice singing Humpty Dumpty, awakening humiliating memories of my first Easter program during which I had stood before the church audience and forgotten the words. "My kid," Hambro said, filibustering against going to bed. "Ha! A real she-lawyer, that kid." The child was singing Hickory Dickory Dock very fast as Hambro shut the door. He was saying something about the child, and I looked at him with sudden irritation. With Reinhardt on my mind, why had I come here? Hambro was so tall that when he crossed his legs, both feet touched the floor. He had been my teacher during my period of indoctrination, and now I realized that I shouldn't have come. Ambrose's lawyer's mind was too narrowly logical. He'd see Reinhardt simply as a criminal, my obsession as a fall into pure mysticism. "You'd better hope that is the way he'll see it," I thought. Then I decided to ask him about conditions uptown and leave. "Look, Brother Hambro," I said, "what's to be done about my district?" He looked at me with a dry smile. "Have I become one of those boors who talk too much about their children?" "Oh, no, it's not that," I said. I've had a hard day. I'm nervous. With Clifton's death and things in the district so bad, I guess..." "Of course," he said, still smiling. "But why are you worried about the district?" "Because things are getting out of hand. Ross's men tried to rough me up tonight, and our strength is steadily going to hell." "Now, that's regrettable," he said, "but there's nothing to be done about it that wouldn't upset the larger plan. It's unfortunate, brother, but your members will have to be sacrificed." The distant child had stopped singing now, and it was dead quiet. I looked at the angular composure of his face, searching for the sincerity in his words. I could feel some deep change. It was as though my discovery of Reinhardt had opened a gulf between us over which, though we sat within touching distance, our voices barely carried and then fell flat without an echo. I tried to shake it away, but still the distance, so great that neither could grasp the emotional tone of the other, remained. "Sacrifice," my voice said. "You say that very easily. Just a shame, though. All who leave must be considered expendable. The new directives must be followed rigidly. It sounded unreal. An antiphonal game. But why, I said. Why must the directives be changed in my district when the old methods are needed? Especially now. Somehow I couldn't get the needed urgency into my words. And beneath it all, something about Reinhardt bothered me. Darted just beneath the surface of my mind, something that had to do with me, intimately. It's simple, Brother, Ambrose said. We are making temporary alliances with other political groups, and the interests of one group of brothers must be sacrificed to that of the whole. Why wasn't I told of this, I said. You will be, in time, by the committee. Sacrifice is necessary now. But shouldn't sacrifice be made willingly by those who know what they are doing? My people don't understand why they're being sacrificed. They don't even know they're being sacrificed, at least not by us. But what, my mind went on, if they're as willing to be duped by the Brotherhood as by Reinhardt? I sat up at the thought, and there must have been an odd expression on my face for Hambro, who was resting his elbows upon the arms of the chair and touching his fingertips together, raised his eyebrows as though expecting me to continue. Then he said, "The disciplined members will understand." I pulled Tarp's leg chain from my pocket and slipped it over my knuckles. Ha! He didn't notice. Don't you realize that we have only a handful of disciplined members left? Today the funeral brought out hundreds who'll drop away as soon as they see we're not following through. And now we're being attacked on the streets. Can't you understand? Other groups are circulating petitions. Ross is calling for violence. The committee is mistaken if they think this is going to die down. He shrugged. It's a risk which we must take. All of us must sacrifice for the good of the whole. Change is achieved through sacrifice. We follow the laws of reality, so we make sacrifices. But the community is demanding equality of sacrifice, I said. We've never asked for special treatment. It isn't that simple, brother, he said. We have to protect our gains. It's inevitable that some must make greater sacrifices than others. That some, being my people... In this instance, yes. So the weak must sacrifice for the strong? Is that it, brother? No. A part of the whole is sacrificed, and will continue to be until a new society is formed. I don't get it, I said. I just don't get it. We work our hearts out trying to get the people to follow us, and just when they do, just when they see their relationship to events, we drop them. I don't see it. Ambrose smiled remotely. We don't have to worry about the aggressiveness of the Negroes, not during the new period or any other. In fact, we now have to slow them down for their own good. It's a scientific necessity. I looked at him, at the long, bony, almost Lincoln-esque face. I might have liked him, I thought. He seems to be a really kind and sincere man, and yet he can say this to me? So you really believe that, I said quietly. With all my integrity, he said. For a second, I thought I'd laugh. Or let fly with Tarp's link. Integrity? He talks to me of integrity? I described a circle in the air. I tried to build my integrity upon the role of brotherhood, and now it had changed to water, air. What was integrity? What did it have to do with a world in which Reinhardt was possible and successful? But what's changed, I said. Wasn't I... brought in to arouse their aggressiveness? My voice fell sad, hopeless. For that particular period, Ambrose said, leaning a little forward. Only for that period. And what will happen now, I said. He blew a smoke ring, the blue-gray circle rising up, boiling within its own jetting form, hovering for an instant, then disintegrating into a weaving strand. Cheer up, he said. We shall progress. Only now... they must be brought along more slowly. How would he look through the green lenses, I thought, saying, "Are you sure you're not saying that they must be held back?" He chuckled. "Now, listen," he said. "Don't stretch me on a rack of dialectic. I'm a brother." "You mean the brakes must be put on the old wheel of history," I said. "Or is it the little wheels within the wheel?" His face sobered. "I mean only that they must be brought along more slowly. They can't be allowed to upset the tempo of the master plan. Timing is all important. Besides, you still have a job to do. Only now it will be more educational." "And what about the shooting?" Those who are dissatisfied will drop away, and those who remain, you'll teach. I don't think I can, I said. Why? It's just as important, because they are against us. Besides, I'd feel like Reinhardt. It slipped out, and he looked at me. Like who? Like a charlatan, I said. Ambrose laughed. I thought you had learned about that, brother. I looked at him quickly. Learned what? That it's impossible not to take advantage of the people. That's Reinhardtism. Cynicism. What? Cynicism, I said. Not cynicism. Realism. The trick is to take advantage of them in their own best interest. I sat forward in my chair, suddenly conscious of the unreality of the conversation. But who is to judge? Jack? The committee? We judge through cultivating scientific objectivity, he said with a voice that had a smile in it. And suddenly I saw the hospital machine felt as though locked in again. Don't kid yourself, I said. The only scientific objectivity is a machine. Discipline, not machinery, he said. We're scientists. We must take the risks of our science and our will to achieve. Would you like to resurrect God to take responsibility? He shook his head. No, brother, we have to make such decisions ourselves, even if we must sometimes appear as charlatans. You're in for some surprises, I said. Maybe so and maybe not, he said. At any rate, through our very position in the vanguard, we must do and say the things necessary to get the greatest number of the people to move toward what is for their own good. Suddenly I couldn't stand it. Look at me! Look at me, I said. Everywhere I've turned, somebody has wanted to sacrifice me for my good. Only they were the ones who benefited. And now we start on the old sacrificial merry-go-round. And at what point do we stop? Is this the new, true definition? Is brotherhood a matter of sacrificing the weak? If so, at what point do we stop? Ambrose looked as though I were not there. At the proper moment, science will stop us. And, of course, we as individuals must sympathetically debunk ourselves, even though it does only a little good. But then, he shrugged, if you go too far in that direction, you can't pretend to lead. You'll lose your confidence. You won't believe enough in your own correctness to lead others. You must therefore have confidence in those who lead you, in the collective wisdom of brotherhood. I left in a worse state than that in which I'd come. Several buildings away, I heard him call behind me, watched him approach through the dark. You left your hat, he said, handing it to me along with the mimeographed sheets of instructions outlining the new program. I looked at the hat and at him, thinking of Reinhardt and invisibility, but knew that for him it would have no reality. I told him good night and went through the hot street to Central Park West, starting toward Harlem. Sacrifice and leadership, I thought. For him, it was simple. For them, it was simple. But how? I was both sacrificer and victim. I couldn't get away from that, and Hambro didn't have to deal with it. That was reality, too, my reality. He didn't have to put the knife blade to his own throat. What would he say if he were the victim? I walked along the park in the dark. Cars passed. From time to time, the sound of voices, squealing, laughter, arose from behind the trees and hedges. I could smell the sun-singed grass. The sky against which an airplane beacon played was still overcast. I thought of Jack, the people at the funeral, Reinhardt. They'd asked us for bread, and the best I could give was a glass eye, not so much as an electric guitar. I stopped and dropped to a bench. I should leave, I thought. That would be the honest thing to do. Otherwise, I can only tell them to have hope and to try to hold on to those who'd listen. Was that also what Reinhardt was, a principle of hope for which they gladly paid? Otherwise, there was nothing but betrayal. And that meant going back to serve Bledsoe and Emerson, jumping from the pot of absurdity to the fire of the ridiculous. And either was self-betrayal. But I couldn't leave. I had to settle with Jack and Tobit. I owed it to Clifton and Tarp and the others. I had to hold on. And then I had an idea that shook me profoundly. You don't have to worry about the people. If they tolerate Reinhardt, then they will forget it. And even with them, you are invisible. It lasted only the fraction of a second, and I rejected it immediately. Still, it had flashed across the dark sky of my mind. It was just like that. It didn't matter because the people didn't realize just what had happened. Neither my hope nor my failure. My ambition and integrity were nothing to them, and my failure was as meaningless as Clifton's. It had been that way all along. Only in the Brotherhood there had seemed a chance for such as us, the mere glimmer of a light, but behind the polished and humane facade of Jack's eye, I'd found an amorphous form and a harsh red rawness. And even that was without meaning except for me. Well, I was, and yet I was invisible. That was the fundamental contradiction. I was, and yet I was unseen. It was frightening, and as I sat there, I sensed another frightening world of possibilities. For now, I saw that I could agree with Jack without agreeing, and I could tell Harlem to have hope when there was no hope. Perhaps I could tell them to hope until I found the basis of something real, some firm ground for action that would lead them onto the plane of history. But until then, I would have to move them without myself being moved. Ha! I'd have to do a Reinhardt. I leaned against the stone wall along the park, thinking of Jack and Hambro and of the day's events, and shook with rage. It was all a swindle, an obscene swindle. They had set themselves up to describe the world. What did they know of us except that we'd numbered so many, worked on certain jobs, offered so many votes, provided so many marchers for some protest parade of theirs? I leaned there, aching to humiliate them, to refute them. And now all past humiliations became precious parts of my experience, and for the first time, leaning against that stone wall in the sweltering night, I began to accept my past. And as I accepted it, I felt memories welling up within me. It was as though I'd learned suddenly to look around corners. Images of past humiliations flickered through my head, and I saw that they were more than separate experiences. They were me. They defined me. I was my experiences, and my experiences were me, and no blind men, no matter how powerful they became, even if they conquered the world, could take that or change one single itch, taunt, laugh, cry, scar, ache, rage, or pain of it. They were blind, bat-blind, moving only by the echoed sounds of their own voices. And because they were blind, they would destroy themselves, and I'd help them. I laughed. Here I had thought. They accepted me because they felt that color made no difference, when in reality it made no difference because they didn't see either color or men. For all they were concerned, we were so many names scribbled on fake ballots to be used at their convenience and, when not needed, to be filed away. It was a joke, an absurd joke. And now I looked around a corner of my mind and saw Jack and Norton and Emerson merge into one single white figure. They were very much the same, each attempting to force his picture of reality upon me and neither giving a hoot in hell for how things looked. To me, I was simply a material, a natural resource to be used. I had switched from the arrogant absurdity of Norton and Emerson to that of Jack and the Brotherhood. It had all come out the same. Except I now recognized my invisibility. So, I'd accept it. I'd explore it, Rhine and heart. I'd plunge into it with both feet, and they'd gag. Oh, but wouldn't they gag? I didn't know what my grandfather had meant, but I was ready to test his advice. I'd overcome them with yeses, undermine them with grins. I'd agree them to death and destruction. Yes, and I'd let them swallow me until they vomited or burst wide open. Let them gag on what they refused to see. Let them joke on it. That was one risk they hadn't calculated. That was a risk they had never dreamt of in their philosophy, nor did they know that they could discipline themselves to destruction. That saying yes could destroy them. Oh, I'd yes them. But wouldn't I yes them? I'd yes them till they puked and rolled in it. All they wanted of me was one belch of affirmation, and I'd bellow it out loud. Yes, yes, yes! That was all anyone wanted of us. That we should be heard and not seen, and then heard only in one big, optimistic chorus of, Yassa! 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 All right, I'd yay and yay and we and see and see and see and see them too. And I'd walk around in their guts with hobnailed boots. Even those super big shots whom I'd never seen at committee meetings. They wanted a machine very well. I'd become a super-sensitive confirmer of their misconceptions, and just to hold their confidence, I'd try to be right part of the time. Oh, I'd serve them well, and I'd make invisibility felt if not seen, and they'd learn that it could be as polluting as a decaying body or a piece of bad meat in a stew. And if I got hurt, very well again, besides. Didn't they believe in sacrifice? They were the subtle thinkers. Would this be treachery? Did the word apply to an invisible man? Could they recognize choice in that which wasn't seen? The more I thought of it, the more I fell into a kind of morbid fascination with the possibility. Why hadn't I discovered it sooner? How different my life might have been. How terribly different. Why hadn't I seen the possibilities? If a sharecropper could attend college by working during the summer as a waiter and a factory hand or as a musician and then graduate to become a doctor, why couldn't all those things be done at one and the same time? And wasn't that old slave a scientist, or at least called one, recognized as one? Even when he stood with his hat in hand, bowing and scraping in senile and obscene servility, my God, what possibilities existed! And that spiral business, that progress goo, who knew all the secrets? Hadn't I changed my name and never been challenged even once? And that lie that success was a rising upward, what a crummy lie they kept us dominated by. Not only could you travel upward toward success, but you could travel downward as well, up and down, in retreat as well as in advance, crabways and crossways and around in a circle, meeting your old selves, coming and going, and perhaps all at the same time. How could I have missed it for so long? Hadn't I grown up around gambler politicians, bootlegger judges, and sheriffs who were burglars? Yes, and Klansmen who were preachers and members of humanitarian societies? Hell, and hadn't Bledsoe tried to tell me what it was all about? I felt more dead than alive. It had been quite a day, one that could not have been more shattering, even if I had learned that the man whom I'd always called father was actually of no relation to me. I went to the apartment and fell across the bed in my clothes. It was hot, and the fan did little more than stir the heat in heavy, leaden waves, beneath which I lay twirling the dark glasses and watching the hypnotic flickering of the lenses as I tried to make plans. I would hide my anger and lull them to sleep, assure them that the community was in full agreement with their program, and as proof I would falsify the attendance records by filling out membership cards with fictitious names, all unemployed, of course, so as to avoid any question of dues. Yes, and I would move about the community by night and during times of danger by wearing the white hat and the dark glasses. It was a dreary prospect, but a means of destroying them, at least in Harlem. I saw no possibility of organizing a splinter movement for what would be the next step. Where would we go? There were no allies with whom we could join as equals, nor were there time or theorists available to work out an overall program of our own. Though I felt that somewhere between Reinhardt and invisibility there were great potentialities. We had no money, no intelligence apparatus, either in government, business, or labor unions, and no communications with our own people except through unsympathetic newspapers, a few Pullman porters who brought provincial news from distant cities, and a group of domestics who reported the fairly uninteresting private lives of their employers. If only we had some true friends, some who saw us as more than convenient tools for shaping their own desires. But to hell with that, I thought. I would remain and become a well-disciplined optimist and help them go merrily to hell. If I couldn't help them to see the realities of our lives, I would help them to ignore it until it exploded in their faces. Only one thing bothered me. Since I now knew that their real objectives were never revealed at committee meetings, I needed some channel of intelligence through which I could learn what actually guided their operations. But how? If only I had resisted being shifted downtown, I would now have enough support in the community to insist that they reveal themselves. Yes, but if I hadn't been shifted, I would still be living in a world of illusion. But now that I had found the thread of reality, how could I hold on? They seemed to have me blocked at every turn, forcing me to fight them in the dark. Finally, I tossed the glasses across the bed and dropped into a fitful nap, during which I relived the events of the last few days, except that instead of Clifton being lost, it was myself, and I awoke stale, sweaty, and aware of perfume. I lay on my stomach, my head resting upon the back of my hand, thinking, where's it coming from? And just as I caught sight of the glasses, I remembered grasping Linehart's girl's hand. I lay there unmoving, and she seemed to perch on the bed, a bright-eyed bird with her glossy head and ripe breasts. And I was in a wood, afraid to frighten the bird away. Then I was fully awake, and the bird gone, and the girl's image in my mind. What would have happened if I had led her on? How far could I have gone? A desirable girl like that mixed up with Reinhardt. And now I sat breathless, asking myself how Reinhardt would have solved the problem of information, and it came instantly clear. It called for a woman. A wife, a girlfriend, or secretary of one of the leaders who would be willing to talk freely to me. My mind swept back to early experiences in the movement. Little incidents sprang to memory, bringing images of the smiles and gestures of certain women met after rallies and at parties. Dancing with Emma at the Thonian, she close, soft against me, and the hot, swift focusing of my desire and my embarrassment as I caught sight of Jack holding forth in a corner, and Emma holding me tight, her bound breasts pressing against me, looking with that teasing light in her eyes, saying, ah, temptation. And my desperate grab for a sophisticated reply and managing only, oh, but there's always temptation, surprising myself nevertheless, and hearing her laughing, touché, touché, you should come up and fence with me some afternoon. That had been during the early days when I had felt strong restrictions and resented Emma's boldness and her opinion that I should have been blacker to play my role of Harlem leader. Well, there were no restrictions left. The committee had seen to that. She was fair game, and perhaps she'd find me black enough after all. A committee meeting was set for tomorrow, and since it was Jack's birthday, a party at the Thonian would follow. Thus, I would launch my two-pronged attack under the most favorable circumstances. They were forcing me to Reinhardt methods. So, bring on the scientists. I started yesing them the next day, and it began beautifully. The community was still going apart at the seams. Crowds formed at the slightest incidents. Store windows were smashed, and several clashes erupted during the morning between bus drivers and their passengers. The papers listed similar incidents that had exploded during the night. The mirrored facade of one store on 125th Street was smashed, and I passed to see a group of boys watching their distorted images as they danced before the jagged glass. A group of adults looked on, refusing to move at the policeman's command and muttering about Clifton. I didn't like the look of things, for all my wish to see the committee confounded. When I reached the office, members were there with reports of clashes in other parts of the district. I didn't like it at all. The violence was pointless and, helped along by Ross, was actually being directed against the community itself. Yet in spite of my sense of violated responsibility, I was pleased by the developments and went ahead with my plan. I sent out members to mingle with the crowds and to try to discourage any further violence and sent an open letter to all the press denouncing them for distorting and inflating minor incidents. Later that afternoon at headquarters, I reported that things were quieting down and that we were getting a large part of the community interested in a cleanup campaign, which would clear all backyards, areaways, and vacant lots of garbage and trash and take Harlem's mind off Clifton. It was such a bare-faced maneuver that I almost lost the confidence of my invisibility, even as I stood before them. But they loved it. And when I handed in my fake list of new members, they responded with enthusiasm. They were vindicated. The program was correct. Events were progressing in their predetermined direction. History was on their side, and Harlem loved them. I sat there smiling inwardly as I listened to the remarks that followed. I could see the role which I was to play as plainly as I saw Jack's red hair. Incidents of my past, both recognized and ignored, sprang together in my mind in an ironic leap of consciousness that was like looking around a corner. I was to be a justifier. My task would be to deny the unpredictable human element of all Harlem so that they could ignore it when it in any way interfered with their plans. I was to keep ever before them the picture of a bright, passive, good-humored, receptive mass ever willing to accept their every scheme. When situations arose in which others would respond with righteous anger, I would say that we were calm and unruffled. If it suited them to have us angry, then it was simple enough to create anger for us by stating it in their propaganda. The facts were unimportant, unreal. And if other people were confused by their maneuvering, I was to reassure them that we pierced to the truth with X-ray insight. If other groups were interested in becoming wealthy, I was to assure the brothers and the doubting members of other districts that we rejected wealth as corrupt and intrinsically degrading. If other minorities loved the country despite their grievances, I would assure the committee that we, immune to such absurdly human and mixed reactions, hated it absolutely. And greatest contradiction of all, when they denounced the American scene as corrupt and degenerate, I was to say that we, though snarled inextricably within its veins and sinews, were miraculously healthy. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Though invisible, I would be their assuring voice of denial. I'd out-Tobit Tobit. And as for the outhouse restroom, well... As I sat there, one of them was inflating my faked memberships into meanings of national significance. An illusion was creating a counter-illusion. Where would it end? Did they believe their own propaganda? Afterwards, at the Thonian, it was like old times. Jack's birthday was an occasion for champagne, and the hot dog day evening was even more volatile than usual. I felt highly confident. But here my plan went slightly wrong. Emma was quite gay and responsive, but something about her hard, handsome face warned me to lay off. I sensed that while she might willingly surrender herself in order to satisfy herself, she was far too sophisticated and skilled in intrigue to compromise her position as Jack's mistress by revealing anything important to me. So as I danced and sparred with Emma, I looked over the party for a second choice. We were thrown together at the bar. Her name was Sybil, and she was one of those who assumed that my lectures on the woman question were based upon a more intimate knowledge than the merely political, and had indicated several times a willingness to know me better. I had always pretended not to understand, for not only had my first experience taught me to avoid such situations, but at the Thonian, she was usually slightly tipsy and wistful, just the type of misunderstood married woman whom, even if I had been interested, I would have avoided like the plague. But now her unhappiness and the fact that she was one of the big shot's wives made her a perfect choice. She was very lonely, and it went very smoothly. In the noisy birthday party, which was to be followed by a public celebration the next evening, we weren't noticed. and when she left fairly early in the evening, I saw her home. She felt neglected, and he was always busy. And when I left her, I had arranged a rendezvous at my apartment for the following evening. George, the husband, would be at the birthday celebration, and she wouldn't be missed. It was a hot, dry August night. Lightning flashed across the eastern sky, and a breathless tension was in the humid air. I had spent the afternoon preparing, leaving the office on a pretense of illness to avoid having to attend the celebration. I had neither itch nor etchings, but there was a vase of Chinese lilies in the living room, and another of American Beauty roses on the table near the bed, and I had put in a supply of wine, whiskey, and liqueur, extra ice cubes, and assortments of fruit, cheese, nuts, candy, and other delicacies from the Vendome. In short, I tried to manage things as I imagined Reinhardt would have done. But I bungled it from the beginning. I made the drinks too strong, which she liked too well, and I brought up politics, which she all but hated, too early in the evening. For all her exposure to ideology, she had no interest in politics and no idea of the schemes that occupied her husband night and day. She was more interested in the drinks, in which I had to join her glass for glass, and in little dramas which she had dreamed up around the figures of Joe Louis and Paul Robeson. And although I had neither the stature nor the temperament for either role, I was expected either to sing Old Man River and just keep rolling along, or to do fancy tricks with my muscles. I was confounded and amused, and it became quite a contest with me trying to keep the two of us in touch with reality, and with her casting me in fantasies in which I was brother taboo with whom all things are possible. Now it was late, and as I came into the room with another round of drinks, she had let down her hair and was beckoning to me with a gold hairpin in her teeth, saying, "Come to Mama, beautiful," from where she sat on the bed. "Your drink, madame," I said, handing her a glass and hoping the fresh drink would discourage any new ideas. "Come, dear," she said coyly. "I want to ask you something." "What is it?" I said. "I have to whisper it, beautiful." I sat, and her lips came close to my ear. And suddenly she had drained the starch out of me. I pulled away. There was something almost prim about the way she sat there, and yet she had just made a modest proposal that I join her in a very revolting ritual. "What was that?" I said, and she repeated it. Had life suddenly become a crazy Thurber cartoon? "Oh, please, you'll do that for me, won't you, beautiful?" "You really mean it?" "Yes," she said, "yes." There was a pristine incorruptibility about her face now that upset me all the more, for she was neither kidding nor trying to insult me. And I could not tell if it were horror speaking to me out of innocence or innocence emerging unscathed from the obscene scheme of the evening. I only knew that the whole affair was a mistake. She had no information, and I decided to get her out of the apartment before I had to deal definitely with either the horror or the innocence while I still could deal with it as a joke. What would Reinhardt do about this, I thought, and, knowing, determined not to let her provoke me to violence. "But, Sybil, you can see I'm not like that. You make me feel a tender, protective passion. Look, it's like an oven in here. Why don't we get dressed and go for a walk in Central Park?" "But I need it," she said, uncrossing her thighs and sitting up eagerly. "You can do it. It'll be easy for you, beautiful. Threaten to kill me if I don't give in. You know, talk rough to me, beautiful. A friend of mine said the fellow said, 'Drop your drawers and—'"
"He said what?" I said.
"He really did," she said. I looked at her. She was blushing. Her cheeks, even her freckled bosom, were bright red.
"Go on," I said as she lay back again. "Then what happened?"
"Well, he called her a filthy name," she said, hesitating coyly. She was a leathery old girl with chestnut hair, a fine natural wave which was now fanned out over the pillow. She was blushing quite deeply. Was this meant to excite me, or was it an unconscious expression of revulsion? "A really filthy name," she said. "Oh, he was a brute, huge, with white teeth, what they call a buck. And he said, 'Bitch, drop your drawers,' and then he did it."
She's such a lovely girl, too, really delicate, with a complexion like strawberries and cream. You can't imagine anyone calling her a name like that.
She sat up now, her elbows denting the pillow as she looked into my face. But what happened? Did they catch him? I said.
Oh, of course not, beautiful. She only told two of us girls. She couldn't afford to let her husband hear of it. Well, it's too long a story.
It's terrible, I said. Don't you think we should go?
Isn't it, though? She was in a state for months.
Her expression flickered, became indeterminate. What is it? I said, afraid she might cry.
Oh, I was just wondering how she really felt. I really do.
Suddenly she looked at me mysteriously.
Can I trust you with a deep secret?
I sat up. Don't tell me that it was you. She smiled.
Oh, no. That was a dear friend of mine. But do you know what, beautiful?
She said, leaning forward confidentially.
I think I'm a nymphomaniac.
You?
No. Uh-huh. Sometimes I have such thoughts and dreams. I never give in to them, though, but I really think I am. A woman like me has to develop an iron discipline.
I laughed inwardly. She would soon be a biddy, stout, and with a little double chin and a three-ply girdle. A thin gold chain showed around a thickening ankle, and yet I was becoming aware of something warmly, infuriatingly feminine about her. I reached out, stroking her hand. "Why do you have such ideas about yourself?" I said, seeing her raise up and pluck at the corner of the pillow, drawing out a speckled feather and stripping the down from its shaft.
"Repression," she said with great sophistication. "Men have repressed us too much. We're expected to pass up too many human things. But do you know another secret?"
I bowed my head.
"You don't mind my going on, do you, beautiful?"
"No, Sybil."
"Well, ever since I first heard about it, even when I was a very little girl, I've wanted it to happen to me."
"You mean what happened to your friend?"
"Uh-huh."
"Good Lord, Sybil. Did you ever tell that to anyone else?"
"Of course not. I wouldn't have dared."
"Are you shocked?"
"Some, but..."
"Sybil, why do you tell me?"
"Oh, I know. I can trust you. I just knew you'd understand. You're not like other men. We're kind of alike."
She was smiling now and reached out and pushed me gently, and I thought, here it goes again.
"Lie back and let me look at you against that white sheet. Oh, you're beautiful. I always thought so. Like warm ebony against pure snow. Oh, see what you do. You make me talk poetry. Warm ebony against pure snow. Isn't that poetic?"
"I'm the sensitive type. You mustn't make fun of me."
"But you really are. And I feel so free with you. You've no idea."
I looked at the red imprint left by the straps of her bra, thinking, who's taking revenge on whom? But why be surprised, when that's what they hear all their lives, when it's made into a great power and they're taught to worship all types of power? With all the warnings against it, some are bound to want to try it out for themselves. The conquerors conquered. Maybe a great number secretly wanted. Maybe that's why they scream when it's farthest from possibility.
"That's it," she said tightly. "Look at me like that, just like you want to tear me apart. Oh, I'd love for you to look at me like that."
I laughed and touched her chin. She had me on the ropes. I felt punch drunk. I couldn't deliver and I couldn't be angry either. I thought of lecturing her on the respect due one's bedmate in our society. But I no longer deluded myself that I either knew the society or where I fitted into it. Besides, I thought, she thinks you're an entertainer. That's something else they're taught. I raised my glass and she joined me in a drink, moving close.
"You will, won't you? Beautiful," she said, her lips raw looking now, without makeup, pouting babyishly.
"So why not entertainer? Be a gentleman, or
whatever it is she thinks you are. What does she think you are? A domesticated rapist, obviously, an expert on the woman question. Maybe that's what you are, housebroken and with a convenient verbal push-button arrangement for the lady's pleasure. Well, so I had set this trap for myself. Take this, I said, shoving another glass into her hand. It'll be better after you've had a drink, more realistic. Oh, yes, that'll be wonderful. She took a drink and looked up thoughtfully. I get so tired of living the way I do, beautiful. Soon I'll be old and nothing will have happened to me. Do you know what that means? Georgie talks a lot about women's rights, but what does he know about what a woman needs? Him with his 40 minutes of brag and 10 of bustle. Oh, you have no idea what you're doing for me. Nor you for me, Sybil dear, I said, filling the glass again. At last my drinks were beginning to work. She shook her long hair out over her shoulders and crossed her knees, watching me. Her head had begun to weave. Oh, don't drink too much, beautiful, she said. It always takes the pep out of George. Oh, don't worry, I said. I'll rape real good when I'm drunk. She looked startled. Oh, then pour me another, she said, giving herself a bounce. She was as delighted as a child, holding out her glass eagerly. What's happening here, I said. A new birth of a nation? What'd you say, beautiful? Nothing. A bad joke. Forget it. That's what I like about you, beautiful. You haven't told me a single one of those vulgar jokes. Come on, beautiful, she said. Pour. I poured her another and another. In fact, I poured us both quite a few. I was far away. It wasn't happening to me or to her, and I felt a certain confused pity which I didn't wish to feel. Then she looked at me, her eyes bright behind narrowed lids, and raised up and struck me where it hurt. Come on. Beat me, Daddy, you big black bruiser. What's taking you so long, she said. Hurry up, knock me down. Don't you want me? I was annoyed enough to slap her. She lay aggressively receptive, flushed, her navel no goblet but a pit in an earth-quaking land, flexing taut and expansive. Then she said, come on, come on. And I said, sure, sure, looking around wildly and starting to pour the drink upon her and was stopped, my emotions locked as I saw her lipstick lying on the table and grabbed it saying yes. Yes, as I bent to write furiously across her belly in drunken inspiration, Sybil, you were raped by Santa Claus. Surprise! And paused there. Trembling above her, my knees on the bed as she waited with unsteady expectancy. It was a purplish metallic shade of lipstick, and as she panted with anticipation, the letters stretched and quivered uphill and down dale, and she was lit up like a luminescent sign. Hurry, boo-fool, hurry, she said. I looked at her, thinking, just wait until George sees that, if George ever gets around to seeing that. He'll read a lecture on an aspect of the woman question he's never thought about. She lay anonymous beneath my eyes until I saw her face, shaped by her emotion, which I could not fulfill, and I thought, poor Sybil. She picked a boy for a man's job, and nothing was as it was supposed to be. Even the black bruiser fell down on the job. She lost control of her liquor now, and suddenly I bent and kissed her upon the lips. Shh, be quiet, I said. That's no way to act when you're being... And she raised her lips for more, and I kissed her again and calmed her, and she dozed off, and I decided again to end the farce. Such games were for Reinhardt, not me. I stumbled out and got a damp towel and began rubbing out the evidence of my crime. It was as tenacious as sin, and it took some time. Water wouldn't do it, whiskey would have smelled, and finally I had to find benzene. Fortunately, she didn't arouse until I was almost finished.
Did you do it, beautiful? She said.
Yes, of course, I said. Isn't that what you wanted?
Yes, but I don't seem to remember.
I looked at her and wanted to laugh. She was trying to see me, but her eyes wouldn't focus and her head kept swinging to one side. Yet she was making a real effort, and suddenly I felt light-hearted. "By the way," I said, trying to do something with her hair, "what's your name, lady?"
"Sybil," she said indignantly, almost tearfully. "Before you know Hans Sybil."
"Not when I grabbed you, I didn't." Her eyes widened and a smile wobbled across her face.
"That's right, you couldn't, could you? You never saw me before," she said delighted.
I could almost see the idea take form in her mind. "That's right," I said. "I leaped straight out of the wall. I overpowered you in the empty lobby, remember? I smothered your terrified screams."
"And I put up a good fight?"
"Like a lioness, defending her young."
"But you were such a strong big brute, you made me give in. I didn't want to. Did I know, Doofoo? You forced me against my will."
"Sure," I said, picking up some silken piece of clothing. "You brought out the beast in me. I overpowered you, but what could I do?" She studied that a while, and for a second her face worked again as though she would cry. But it was another smile that bloomed there.
"And wasn't I a good nymphomaniac?"
she said, watching me closely.
"Really and truly?"
"You have no idea," I said. "George, I'd better keep an eye on you." She twisted herself from side to side with irritation.
"Oh, nuts. That old Georgie porridge, you wouldn't know a nymphomaniac if she got right into bed with him."
"You're wonderful," I said. "Tell me about George. Tell me about that great mastermind of social change." She studied her gaze, frowning.
"Oh, Georgie?"
she said, looking at me out of one bleary eye.
"George is blind small in a hole and doesn't know a thing about it. Did you ever hear of such a thing 15 years? Say, what are you laughing at, beautiful?"
"Me?" I said, beginning to roar. "Just me."
"I've not seen anyone laugh like you, beautiful. It's wonderful."
I was slipping her dress over her head now, and her voice came muffled through the shantung cloth. Then I had it down around her hips, and her flushed face wavered through the collar, her hair down in disorder again.
"Beautiful," she said, blowing the word. "Will you do it again sometimes?"
I stepped away and looked at her. "What?"
"Please, pretty beautiful, please,"
she said with a wobbly smile. I began to laugh. Sure, I said, sure.
"When? Beautiful, when?"
Any time," I said. "How about every Thursday at 9?
"Oh, beautiful," she said,
giving me an old-fashioned hug.
"I've never seen anyone like you."
"Are you sure?" I said.
"Really, I haven't, beautiful. I'm right. Believe me."
"Sure. It's good to be seen. But we've got to go now," I said, seeing her about to sag to the bed. She pouted.
"I need a little nightcap, beautiful,"
she said. "You've had enough," I said.
"Oh, beautiful, just one."
"Okay, just one." We had another drink, and I looked at her and felt the pity and self-disgust returning and was depressed. She looked at me gravely, her head to one side.
"Beautiful," she said, "you know what little old Sybil thinks? She thinks you're trying to get rid of her."
I looked at her out of a deep emptiness and refilled her glass and mine. What had I done to her? Allowed her to do? Had all of it filtered down to me? My action? The painful word formed as disconnectedly as her wobbly smile. My responsibility? All of it? I'm invisible. "Here," I said, "drink."
"You too, beautiful,"
she said. "Yes," I said. She moved into my arms. I must have dozed. There came the tinkling of ice in the glass, the shrill of bells. I felt profoundly sad, as though winter had fallen during the hour. She lay, her chestnut hair let down, watching through heavy-lidded, blue-eyeshadowed eyes. From far away, a new sound arose.
"Don't answer, beautiful,"
she said, her voice coming through suddenly, out of time with the working of her mouth. "What?"
"Don't answer, let it ring,"
she said, reaching her red-nailed fingers forth. I took it from her hands, understanding now.
"Don't, Bufo,"
she said. It rang again in my hand now, and for no reason at all the words of a childhood prayer spilled through my mind like swift water. Then, "Hello," I said. It was a frantic, unrecognizable voice from the district.
"Brother, you better get up here right away," it said.
"I'm ill," I said. "What's wrong?"
"There's trouble, brother, and you're the only one who can..."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Bad trouble, brother. They're trying to..."
Then the harsh sound of breaking glass, distant, brittle and fine, followed by a crash, and the line went dead. "Hello," I said, seeing Sybil wavering before me, her lips saying,
"Buffo?"
I tried to dial now, hearing the busy signal throbbing back at me. "Amen, amen, amen, amen." And I sat there a while. Was it a trick? Did they know she was with me? I put it down. Her eyes were looking at me from out of their blue shadow.
"Boo!"
And now I stood and pulled her arm. "Let's go, Sybil. They need me uptown," realizing only then that I would go.
"No,"
she said. "But yes, come." She fell back upon the bed, defying me. I released her arms and looked around, my head unclear. What kind of trouble at this hour? Why should I go? She watched me, her eyes brightly awash in blue shadow. My heart felt low and deeply sad.
"Come back, Buffo," she said.
"No, let's get some air," I said. And now, avoiding the red, oily nails, I gripped her wrists and pulled her up toward the door. We tottered, her lips brushing mine as we wavered there. She clung to me, and for an instant I to her with a feeling immeasurably sad. And then she hiccuped, and I looked vacantly back into the room, the light caught in the amber liquid of our glasses.
"Beautiful," she said. "Life could be so different."
"But it never is," I said.
She said, "Beautiful."
The fan whirred, and in a corner my briefcase covered with specks of dust like memories. The night of the Battle Royal. I felt her breathing hot against me and pushed her gently away, steadying her against the doorframe. Then went over as impulsively as the remembered prayer and got the briefcase, brushing the dust against my leg and feeling the unexpected weight as I hugged it beneath my arm. Something clinked inside. She watched me still, her eyes alight as I took her arm. "How are you doing, Sib?" I said.
"Don't go, Buffo," she said. "Let Georgie do it. No speeches tonight."
"Come on," I said, taking her arm quite firmly, pulling her along as she sighed, her wistful face turned toward me. We went down smoothly into the street. My head was still badly fuzzed from the drink, and when I looked down the huge emptiness of the dark, I felt like tears. What was happening uptown? Why should I worry over bureaucrats, blind men? I am invisible. I stared down the quiet street, feeling her stumbling beside me, humming a little tune, something fresh, naive, and carefree. Sybil, my too-late, too-early love. Ah, my throat throbbed. The heat of the street clung close. I looked for a taxi, but none was passing. She hummed beside me, her perfume unreal in the night. We moved into the next block, and still, no taxis. Her high heels unsteadily scrunched the walk. I stopped her.
"Poor Buffo," she said. "Don't know his name."
I turned as though struck. "What?"
"Anonymous Brute and Buffo Buck,"
she said, her mouth a bleary smile. I looked at her skittering about on her high heels, scrunch, scrunch on the walk. "Sybil," I said more to myself than to her, "where will it end?" Something told me to go.
"Ah," she laughed. "In bed. But don't go up, Buffo. Sybil'll tuck you in."
I shook my head. The stars were there, high, high, revolving. Then I closed my eyes, and they sailed red behind my lids. Then, somewhat steadied, I took her arm. "Look, Sybil," I said, "stand here a minute while I go over the Fifth for a taxi. Stand right here, dear, and hold on." We tottered before an ancient-looking building, its windows dark. Huge Greek medallions showed in spots of light upon its facade, above a dark labyrinthine pattern in the stone, and I propped her against the stoop with its carved stone monster. She leaned there, her hair wild, looking at me in the streetlight, smiling. Her face kept swinging to one side, her right eye desperately closed.
"Sure, Buffo, sure,"
she said. I'll be right back, I said, backing away.
Boofle, she called. My Boofle.
Hear the true affection, I thought. The adoration of the boogie bear moving away. Was she calling me beautiful or boogieful? Beautiful or sublime? What did either mean? I am invisible. I went on through the late street quiet, hoping that a cab would pass before I had gone all the way. Up ahead at Fifth, the lights were bright, a few cars shooting across the gaping mouth of the street, and above and beyond, the trees. Great, dark, tall. What was going on, I wondered. Why call for me so late?